Hey members, welcome to our third episode of Greystone Unscripted. Before I get into introducing my guest today and getting into the podcast, I wanted to share with you a few things, make sure you're aware of. Ticket sales for regions are still ongoing. If you decide to buy tickets, $350 for the package for the family, and we have every member's lanyard already made up and printed, so it's not a problem if you're just late to the game. We'd love to have you join us for the week. It's going to be an incredible time. We have some great bands and really excited about everything planned. So please still plan on coming to Regions. Also wanted to share a little bit about the project at Legacy at the parking lot. There's been a lot of questions. It was necessary to take all those trees out because we're expanding. We're going to have 34 extra spots. We're also going to expand all the slots to 10.5 feet versus the 9.5 they are today, similar to what we did at Founders a couple years ago. So we'll take all those little nooks and crannies out of the way that that is shaped right now, so it'll be more straight line, and it was a necessity to get those trees out, unfortunately. But we're really looking forward to a great project. It'll start June 1st. If we have good weather, we're probably looking at about 4 to 6 weeks for that project, and we'll still stay open during that time as well, so that's why it's going to take a little while. Looking forward to it. It's going to be a great improvement for the club. We have a lot of exciting things planned, and let's get into what we have going on here today with our incredible guest. I want to introduce you, if you don't know, our incredible director of instruction, Mark Blackburn, is with us today. He's the owner of Blackburn Academy, and he is the 2020 PGA Teacher of the Year, and he's currently the number one teacher in America by Golf Digest and one of the most acclaimed people in golf today. So super excited to have Mark here with us today. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be here. It's nice to be at home here at the beautiful Greystone.
Thank you so much. One of the things I wanted to try to do today with our podcast is get the members to really learn more about you. I think they're super proud of you and know all the great things that you've accomplished. But, you know, some of the stories that you shared with me over the years about how you got into this and how you grew up are so impressive and tells everybody so much about your leadership. How about, if you don't mind kicking it off, how'd you get interested in golf when you're a child and growing up?
Yeah, so my grandfather and my dad used to play a lot of golf. And in the UK, it was one of those things. This is going back,
you know,
80s, so a long time ago. It was, kids weren't that well encouraged to play golf. So I would go caddy and I would, like, be around the golf course. My grandfather got me a putter, I think, and a wedge when I was probably about 10, but I played every other sport. So I didn't even get to golf until I was late. And then I kind of took it up when I was about 14 and had done with playing rugby, getting injured, and soccer and all these other games. So I kind of got addicted to golf and then sort of fell into it. And that was, I was a late to golf, but other sports had helped. I guess I was a pretty rounded athlete, not a great athlete by any means, but golf, I kind of then got into it and kind of fell in love with it and spent most of my time on the golf course versus on my academics, which probably wasn't great at the time, but it's all kind of worked out as it was probably supposed to. And then because I was a late bloomer to golf, the way the UK system is, and most people know, most English people are pretty pessimistic and Americans are optimistic, which is why I live here. I missed all of the sort of advanced coaching opportunities. And so I wanted to play college golf, but had to kind of figure a way around it. So I ended up going to a tournament in North Carolina and got offered some scholarships and ended up coming to America to play college golf. And then I played college golf. And then after that, I played for a couple of years and then kind of got injured, but really realistically wasn't good enough at probably playing, but was fascinated by the swing and spent most of my time on the range when I was playing mini tours, which is never a good idea anyway. You should probably be playing golf. And that kind of how I fell into teaching.
Okay. But then how'd you get to, after you got out of college, what was the next move after you figured, when you realized the mini tour was done and you're going to start focusing on some other aspect of golf?
So when the way it worked in the UK is when you were when you finished college, you were like on your own. So I wanted to try and play golf, so I had to find sponsors. So I found some sponsors in Gunnersville. They gave me a place to live, which was in a car barn maintenance shed, which is a running joke. I used to live in a car barn maintenance shed, which was interesting at 5 o'clock in the morning, very loud. But basically, the club I was at, said, okay, well, one of the sponsors I had owned this course, and he was like, look, you spend a lot of time helping members and teaching when you're not playing golf. I'll help you if you want to get into teaching. And that's kind of how that happened. And then up in Gunnersville at Gunners Landing, so Alan Walker is a really close friend of mine, like a surrogate dad, and he basically kind of helped me. I had to do all the work, but he was definitely very helpful. And that kind of where I started teaching. And then, so Sand Mountain's where I cut my teeth in coaching, which is very interesting, especially given the dialect up there.
Nice.
So, and then I was based there. Then I kind of started doing some teaching at the Ledges, and I was the director of instruction at the Ledges in Huntsville. And then in 13, I kind of got headhunted here, and that's how I ended up at Greystone. So Greystone's kind of been, I would say, the launch pad for, like, I was already doing quite well, but the club and the board, and obviously when you came on, Greystone's been a great platform and a foundation for me to kind of go on and do lots of cool stuff. So yeah, I'm love being here and plan on this being my home base for the forever until I stop teaching.
Most people don't know this story, but you'll recall when I bring it up that there's I owe you a huge debt of gratitude and forever in debt that you remember. I got here because you, because of our connection, that I was applying and they had already finished the search and they were pretty close to giving an offer to somebody. And then the general manager at the Ledges was an old friend of mine from South Carolina. And I said, you know anybody in Birmingham applying at Greystone? He's like, yeah, I know Mark, the director of instruction. So he asked you to put them in touch with me, and I'd already had my resume in. So it gave me a chance for an interview before they offered somebody else a job. And here I am. Thank the Lord and blessed to be here.
Yeah, we're a good team.
Yeah, absolutely. I was lucky. I saw David Spivey recently.
How's he doing?
He's good. He's working at Kalawassee in South Carolina.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. What do you have any mentors from the coaching standpoint that members would want to know about?
No, it's really interesting. So I get asked this a lot, and unfortunately, I didn't have the means, so to speak, to like go basically travel around and see a bunch of people. So, and this is before the internet, so I'd buy a lot of books. When I could I'd go watch people. I wouldn't say I really had one mentor, which now in the big picture is probably good because I kind of have a bunch of different influences, not just one. Whereas the traditional hierarchy of like becoming a renowned coach was you went and worked for Jim McClain, or you went and worked for David Ledbetter, or you worked for Mike Adams, or you worked for Chuck Cook. So I didn't have any of that. Now, I spent some time around all those people, but I was never like indoctrinated with like, this is the method. So I was never a disciple of one. So I kind of, if you like, took a little bit from everywhere. And I think that might be beneficial because I had to carve my own way. But in a way, if it didn't work, I didn't necessarily use it. And I think now I tend to be a bit more pragmatic. And for me, I think it was a blessing and a curse in a way. It was a bit of a curse because it took longer to do it, but it's a blessing in the long run because I think you're a bit more rounded for it. There's right. No like one influence, because if you go take a lesson from someone that's worked for Jim or for Chuck, there's a very strong emphasis on their philosophy. Whereas the players I coach, my best calling card is nobody swings the same.
Right. I think it's so great though that people don't come to you saying, oh, go to Mark because he's a disciple of this person or that person. Here's Mark Blackburn. You got your style, your philosophies. And like you said, you can take something from everyone.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, there's no original ideas. It's more like, how do you put them together? And then what's the style that you communicate with? And one of the things I would say I do probably differently is I try and make it kind of fun. Like our whole culture here is instruction is supposed to be fun and enjoyable. And I think even when you're working with the best players in the world, if you can make it sort of entertaining and enjoyable and it's an experience learning, they like it, I think that's a lot better. And traditionally golf's been so formal and structured and kind of like boring and stale, and there's never been any interaction. There's very much been dogmatic from the coach.
Right.
I just don't think that works. And I think my style's a little bit different, which isn't for everybody. Like we have five instructors here, and some people will not like taking a lesson from me, but they might love Brian, Liz, Lane, and the rest of the team. So that's the whole point. I encourage everybody to have your own style, and there's always going to be certain students that gravitate towards right. You because of your style. I might be too sarcastic for some people, but you know, some people might like that. So right. Again, you just got to know that not everyone's going to love you and be comfortable with that.
But how about now the opposite side of it, of now that you have all these people working for you, are they, do you feel like they're true disciples of your style, or you have certain principles that they have to handle and within their teaching, and then you let them be themselves?
This is a great question. So I would say my philosophy is more of every person that walks through the door has their own physicality. So like we screen people and we look at how do you move. That's the, if you like, the framework within which the instructor operates. Now, based on that, there's certain principles like that you need to have, everybody who plays golf, but you should have enough latitude where you can teach people completely different techniques, but based on how they move and how they present. So junior might be different to one of our senior members. Conceptually, they're still trying to hit golf shots, but how you make them do that is just dependent on their own unique characteristics. And I think everybody at the academy is kind of has the basis of how do you move, what do you do, and then we'll build the golf swing around you and what you're wanting to do, not, oh, this is what we think you should do. There's a big difference there. So I'd say that's the part that's probably the commonality between everybody, but the difference is their interpretation of it. As long as they're following the framework of, oh, I need to do this to hit this shot, it's fine.
It might be a little different when you have a 50 to 70-year-old guy that's a high handicap that can't even touch his toes, and then you got a kid that's 16 that can do backflips.
100%. So that's, again, it's like, what are people, most people say they want a golf lesson, they come get a golf lesson, and then they don't really want to change very much. So it's like figuring out what's someone actually going to do, what's their commitment level, how compliant are they going to be with the practice. So again, that's all part of the initial interview of like figuring out what does somebody want to do. Some people just want to go out there and hit balls on the range, and they're like, love to practice. They don't really like to play golf. And then you've got some people who love to play golf and hate practicing. So all those things you have to identify, and then the prescription you give somebody, that's going to determine, you know, based on their what, how much they want to practice. But yeah, everyone's different. So some people might be a lot more, let's say, cues and suggestions, and then some people might be really structured. It just depends.
Is it frustrating? It has to be when you give everybody the tools, the prescription, and then they don't even practice in between until the next lesson. And then maybe they went out and played a couple times, but they weren't really practicing.
Yeah. It, for sure.
And you're expected to get better?
Yeah. Well, that's the hard part, right? It's like going to the doctor and the doctor tells you what to do, take these pills, or this is where you should change your diet, and people come back and they haven't done anything. So there's some people that's what they do. Their practice is essentially showing up at the golf lesson. But that's fine. Right. If I already know that, it's not a problem. Like I'm already, that's their weekly, like, okay, they're coming to see us. So it just depends. But yeah, if you... The work you do outside of the lesson is probably your golf game is a reflection of what you put into it. It's very obvious. It's like, I can tell if you've done something or you haven't. And like, people are, oh, I haven't practiced very much. That's basically coach speak for I've done nothing.
Yeah. The hardest part is probably when you get somebody that's probably, I just hypothetically, an 8 to a 12 handicap, they want to get as close to scratch as they can, and they're only coming to you once a week because they're busy at work or whatever, and they're not, and then they're playing on the weekend, but they're not actually practicing. And you're like, if you really want to achieve your goal, this can happen, but it's not easy because you're already pretty good.
Yeah.
Or just trying to take a couple strokes here and there.
Most people could do it. The hard part is that the expectation of their goal doesn't really match the input that they're willing to put in, right?
Yeah.
And I think that if those are off set, badly, no good. If those are aligned, it could be people can do amazing things. And the hard part about golf is it takes a lot of time.
Right.
You need volume to like get better at it. And when people see the best players in the world, they've been playing for years and they're playing every day pretty much. And it's a, you know, sun up to sun down for most people. So it's really hard. We all can look out and watch guys that come and play regions and be like, man, I can hit that shot on that hole. But you can maybe 1 in 100, but they're doing it pretty much every hole. And that's the whole part. So yeah, people need to figure out how much do they want to put into their golf game. I think most people can definitely get a lot better. Mm-hmm. Most people aren't willing to invest what's necessary. They think they can go get a fitting, buy a club, and that's it. Well, the reality is your sweat and tears in it probably is the biggest correlation to you playing better.
Right, that's a good point. What do you think the big difference is? I mean, is there really that much of a difference to get fitted clothes?
For sure, yeah. I mean, the thing is now technology has made golf so much easier. that you're crazy. If you're a member of a club and you're paying dues every month, you should invest in your, at least biannually, you should invest in your equipment and looking at, okay, is it fit for me correctly? Because you can have a great swing and have the clubs fitted incorrectly and the ball will go sideways. So you want something to help you, and you can somewhat buy a game. So I'd tell people fitting is really important if you're serious about your game. Best analogy would be, what size shoe do you wear?
10.5.
Okay, so if you wear a 10.5, but you like the look of a size 8.5, and you just put an 8.5 on and try and walk around, and you're going to have some serious problems. You like it, but it may not be fit for you, right? You're going to have issues. Point. It's the same thing with a golf club. So lots of people, they like the look of something. It may not necessarily be best for them. It may not be the right size. Those things then lead to bad technique and a whole comedy of errors, which could be avoided if you went and got fit by our golf stuff.
No, that's a great example. I mean, I've done it. It's a great experience, and I'm not a good golfer, but it helped my game. And most recently, you helped my son get clubs, and he got fitted. And before that, he had off the shelf, and he's 6'5", and lefty, but off the shelf, and is bent over so far that he could barely swing the club, so he automatically went from being like a 25 handicap to a 15 because he'd get off the tee a lot better,
yeah.
And his irons are a lot better. That's funny how important that is.
Yeah, no, if you get fit, you've got a chance, and if you don't get fit, you could get really frustrated, spend a lot of unnecessary time out here just beating your head against the wall when you could probably do a lot better with the clubs that were fit for you. And the technology gets better, so clubs potentially this year could be even better than the clubs that were last year, especially in some of the woods. So it's a bit of a sales pitch, it sounds like, but it's the truth. That's why they spend so much money on the R&D of these club companies.
Right. Have you had a chance to go into the companies? What do they make?
Yeah. I mean, Titleist is pretty incredible. I'm one of their leadership advisory staff, so like I spend a lot of time with engineers when I'm on the West Coast in Oceanside and at their research test facility. And it is fascinating to see that the sort of genius that goes into designing golf clubs is unbelievable. So there's a lot of precision involved, and Titleist are pretty good because they only bring clubs out every 2 years. So everything's on a two-year cycle. So a new driver every 2 years, a new iron every 2 years. So as soon as the other one's out, they're already on the next generation. But the amount of research that goes into it is incredible. It's like a car or an aeroplane. I mean, they use wind tunnels, the whole shooting match. It's pretty cool.
Have you had the opportunity to like give them the input?
Yeah, I've definitely spent a bit of time with engineers. This spring, they're looking at doing some things in their biomechanics lab to do with club kinetics. So I've kind of had a bit of input on that, which is fun. So interesting.
That's awesome. A couple more topics for you today. Kind of switch gears into the players on tour that you teach. I know you've shared with me before, and I've heard you a couple times, but our members might not know how your first player that you actually, how that relationship became, and then how you've kind of fast forward moved to where you are today.
Yeah. So the first guy I started with was Keith Slocum, which is about 21 years ago. His caddy was the best man in my wedding at the time, and Heath was struggling in 04. And he basically asked for some help. So I went to see him in Pensacola, and then I ended up going to New Orleans with him, I think. And then he went on and did miss a cut and won that year in Jackson. And that was kind of my Willy Wonka golden ticket. That's the analogy I use. And then over the years, I added other players. Then in 08, I added Robert Carlson. And then I added Robert Carlson from Sweden. And he went on in 08 to won the European Order of Merit. Kind of before social media was really big, so it didn't really get a lot of exposure. But that was my first sort of taste of quite good success. Multiple Ryder Cup winner, won a lot of events that year. And that he actually played with Tiger, and when Tiger won Torrey Pines on the Saturday, I was walking around that group, watched Tiger play on a broken leg, quite amazing. But he was with that, Rob was in the group with him. And then from there, it snowballed into lots of other players. And now This year I've got 10 guys. So yeah, it's busy across all the tours. So between the DP World Tour, the PGA Tour, and the LPGA Tour, it's quite busy. So it's good. I mean, you spend a lot of time on the road, but it's fun to be able to coach the best players in the world and then get them back here to Greystone, to the lab, and to work there is really, really cool. So
couple of those players, can you share?
Yeah, of course. So Everyone's probably familiar with Justin Rose. I've worked with Justin for about 3 years, so obviously he's runner-up in the last two majors. I thought he had half a sleeve and a green jacket this year, but Rory had other thoughts. So Rosie, I started working with Russell Henley at the beginning of the year, and obviously he won Bay Hill, which is pretty cool. I work with Charlie Hoffman. I work with Trey Mullinax, who's a Greystone member. I work with Alex Fitzpatrick, Matt's little brother. I now work with Matt Fitzpatrick as well recently. I work with Adam Hadwin, Daniel Berger, who's playing really well this year, Matthew Pavon, who's a Frenchman. Who else have I got here? I'm missing. Robert Carlson on the Champions Tour, who will be playing at Regions in a couple of weeks. I'm missing somebody else. LPGA's Morgan Matreau. That's a young lady. She's Swiss. She was the girl that was leading the Olympics for three rounds and then didn't play very well the final round. And who else? I'm gone completely brain dead. It'll come to me.
They won't be upset.
No, they won't be upset.
But that leads me to this thing. I was watching this YouTube video of you on the course, and this is, if I was you, I would have drove me nuts. I want to see how you felt about it. Is you're doing a practice round, walking the course with Max and his caddy, and my goodness, the caddy thought he was his coach. I swear, I was ready to go crazy for you. I mean, is that the most frustrating thing when the caddy's trying to give them beyond which club they should use?
It's quite an interesting comment because, to be fair, the caddies are the coaches on the ground, so to speak. So you usually have a really good rapport with caddies. There's Joe Greiner, who's actually he resigned from Max's bag, and now he's just got hired by Colin Morikawa starting next week. But if it's a good caddy and there's someone you trust, they're with the player all the time, it's okay. Sometimes caddies can be a little too involved. But again, it's like we all have a lane. I tend to kind of sit back and speak when needed, but there's lots of people around players now. It used to be where it's just a coach. Well, now we've got a short game coach, sometimes we've got a putting coach, we've got an analytics expert, we've got a nutritionist, we've got a performance director, we got a PT, we got a trainer, you got an agent, you've got the players' wives. I mean, there's a lot of people around. So it's definitely you're a cog in the wheel, so to speak, and sometimes you just sit back and laugh. But I tell everyone I live in a circus. The PGA Tour is not the real world. It's like a full-on circus, and you're just part of it. This traveling circus that goes around. Everyone thinks it's glamorous, but it's like Barnum and Bailey stuff. It's unbelievable.
I'm glad I asked, so that I understand it better. I mean, he seemed like he was very knowledgeable. It was just, I don't know if you both are sharing the same information, but it was interesting to watch you guys out there when you're teaching him while he's playing.
Yeah. Cool.
That was a cool experience. Switching gears to the Performance Center here.
Yep.
Any future thoughts that you want to see have happen? As I know, we both love being here and want to stay here for a long time. So I'm sure you think in your mind what you.
Yeah. No. I mean, look, I think we built that building in 2014, so it's been about 10 years. It's been incredible. I mean, we've basically outgrown it. We don't really have enough space anymore. I'd love to, with the level of volume we have, I'd love to have more bays. I'd like to have more storage space. I'd like to have a putting studio, like a bit more office space so we can do more golf schools, things like that. My goal would be to be at Greystone until I hang it up, be done. So, yeah, I'd like to invest a bit more into the facility. If there's ever a way to get access from Saddle Creek so members could just drive up and be able to practice, that would be enormous. It's great. You'd get a short game area back there, a putting green, so we could be completely isolated. Like, that would be great because then it wouldn't interrupt with daily operations. I think that would be awesome. I'd just like to make it better and better. I mean, if you look at where the club is now, from when I started, I remember I gave my first lesson to Dr. McCabe's door down there on January the 1st, 2014. And to think where we are now, like the club, the facilities, the courses, it's incredible. So I'd love to be able to continually keep improving and get it to be like one of the best destination golf schools in the country. That would be my goal. So yes, if we can do it, I'd love to.
And if we could someday build cottages, that would help you.
Love cottages. Love to be able to have people come stay. And I think that would help. National memberships would be great for us as well. So, but sure. The other thing on the teaching center, if we can expand it, like the goal would be to where it's more of a community center where members have access, can come in and use it, and it can be a meeting point. Do you know what I mean? Where we can have somebody there all the time, manning a desk. We can have some bays where members can practice, play. I think that would be really cool because it would be a nucleus and it would encourage, I think it would help grow our membership even more, even though we're nearly capped out. I just think it would be a great thing for the club and it would draw people to it, especially juniors and people wanting to get into the game, which is going to be the legacy for us to continue this place.
Right. Do you ever see an opportunity for a second location over here?
That would be great. I mean, this range is just a little short, unless we're going to fill that pond in. That's the only thing.
All right, good. We'll get started on that. I just think it'd be really cool if there was some type of opportunity to do it, have two locations.
Yeah, well, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that if there's a desire there, and you look, people like simulators, they like to play, they like to be at the course, and time is a constraint now. Practice facilities are becoming more and more popular. So, like, that's a time access for people to get out here and get improve their game.
Maybe a staffed simulator facility.
Yeah, if for sure.
There's a lot of teaching going on instead of just fun.
Yeah.
Might be something. I saw a really great one at Medina.
Yes.
Where they had, you know, bar in there and lots of areas to coach and teach, but also for fun.
Yeah, and I think that's, when I say community center, my vision is, there can be a bar in there. It can be manned. People can come hang out. Like, you can be around playing and practicing, especially like if the weather's bad or in the wintertime, you can actually continue to work on your game.
Right. That's awesome. How about just before we get to the end here, a little bit about your family, kids?
Yeah.
Got members get to know more about you.
Yeah. So we live in the neighborhood. 1333 Legacy. So we're there. I've got three kids, twin boy girl, Rex and Marin, who are turning 16 this year. So watch out, drivers in the neighborhood. And then I also have a 9-year-old daughter, Nyla, and my wife, Melissa. So they're very active. They're here at Spain Park and Greystone Elementary. My kids are big into music. My son is getting into golf, which is quite interesting. He hasn't yet got to the standard where he can play out here on his own. He tends to go to Oak Mountain. I don't think he feels appropriate to play at the Stone yet. But they love living here, love being in the neighborhood. And we put a pool in this year. So we're kind of firmly rooted in the neighborhood and in the community, which is really good. And we love being here. So I'm excited to hopefully be part of it for the foreseeable future.
We're the lucky ones. So I want to thank you for being with me today. It's been great.
No, loved it.
The members are going to enjoy hearing a little bit more about your story. We're really lucky and blessed to have you here, and I'm very fortunate to work with you.
I appreciate you and all the opportunities you've given me and the club, and the members have been great. So I definitely think that it's a big part of my success is for sure being here at Greystone and the membership, giving me the opportunity, and then your leadership has been great. So thanks to the board, thanks to you members, thanks Dave. Here's to the future.
Thank you, Mark. Members, thanks so much for being with us at our podcast here today, Greystone Unscripted. Hopefully you enjoyed the episode. We'll talk to you soon.